All you have to do is put Saddam Hussein on a bumper sticker with a weapon, and the American public will go along.
There's an effort to conjure up fear here, because they're dead set on a war, and they want to divert people away from what's going on here, and they want to take over those resources.
Amnesty International is concerned these human rights records are being used selectively in order to achieve political goals.
Wrong. We don't have anything. Never have, never did, never will.
This is not about the axis of evil. I think this is really about access to oil.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, December 3rd, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. As Washington continues to cast doubts on the ability of the United Nations weapons inspectors in Iraq, the team launched a surprise inspection of one of Saddam Hussein's presidential palaces overnight. The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said he was pleased with the progress and he praised Iraqi cooperation. Meanwhile, speaking at a Pentagon briefing Tuesday afternoon, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld downplayed the success of the weapons inspections, and he repeated the U.S. claim that Iraq harbors weapons of mass destruction, but he failed again to offer any concrete evidence.
The United States knows that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. The U.K. knows that they have weapons of mass destruction. Any country on the face of the earth with an active intelligence program knows that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction.
Well, will you be able to tell whether they've completely accounted for those?
I have no idea what their declaration will say. It seems to me if one looked across the spectrum, Iraq could on the one hand say, wrong, we don't have anything, never have, never did, never will. They could move over on the spectrum and saying, you're right, we used to. And all the stuff the UN said we had when they came in here and found it and started destroying it all, that's all we ever had. It's all been destroyed. That's the second option. The third option, they could come in and say, we used to have it, and almost all of it was destroyed. But, gee, look over here. We just figured out maybe there's a couple of more buckets of this and a couple of more buckets of that. And here it is. You guys, throw it away. Take care of it for you. Now we're clean. So that's a possibility. There's a variety of things like that that could happen. And why try to prejudge them when it's not for me or anyone except the president?
You seem to be saying that if Iraq is given a clean bill of health by UN inspectors...
I don't think that the UN inspectors are in a position to do that.
How can they say they have not found weapons?
Is that a clean bill of health? If the responsibility is on Iraq to demonstrate that it does not have weapons of mass destruction under the UN resolution, it is not for some country to go in and give them a clean bill of health. It is for Iraq to give itself a clean bill of health by saying, here's honestly what we currently have. Here's where it is. Here's what we've done. Please destroy it for us.
I'm confused by the way the president has characterized some of these things, and this is a slight change in direction here. The president has said that Iraqi cooperation is not encouraging yesterday, and Kofi Annan today says cooperation seems to be good by the Iraqis.
Is the glass half empty, half full?
Well,
I don't see
any,
that that's a big deal.
You don't?
No.
Mr. Secretary? I mean, they seem to be doing what is being asked of them by inspectors, and by that Kofi Annan says cooperation seems to be good. Why is cooperation not good?
You'd have to ask the president.
They're letting people in.
Maybe he's looking at intelligence that somebody else isn't seeing. I don't know.
Rumsfeld also called for Iraq to comply with the UN resolution to disclose and eliminate all of its alleged weapons of mass destruction, and he cited a recent British dossier on Iraq's history of human rights abuses as justification for going to war.
Resolution 1441 also calls for Iraq to end repression of its civilian population. That repression is well documented in the British government's new human rights dossier, which details the systematic terror that the Iraqi regime has and is currently inflicting on its own people. According to the UK report, some 100,000 Kurds in northern Iraq, innocent men, women, and children, have been killed. Shiite Muslims, who make up more than half of the population of that country, have also been systematically attacked, and millions of Iraqis have been forced to flee their homeland. Torture is systematic in Iraq, and the most senior officials in the regime are involved. Electric shock, eye gouging, acid baths, lengthy confinement in small metal boxes are only some of the crimes committed by this regime. That this pattern of human rights violations seems not of concern to some nations is disturbing. The British human rights dossier ought to remind us why Iraq's pursuit of weapons of mass destruction should be of the utmost concern to free people everywhere.
War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld at a Pentagon briefing Tuesday afternoon. The British dossier, he cited, has been the source of quite a bit of controversy over in the United Kingdom. Amnesty International, whose reports were used in the construction of the dossier, has charged the British and American governments with manipulating its findings to suit their own political purposes. I spoke earlier with Ariella Blatter, Amnesty International's Director of Crisis Preparedness and Response. I see a report that the British government was caught manipulating information on human rights abuses in Iraq to build its case for war. The question that leaps to mind is, why would anyone have to fudge the facts? There's certainly enough of a human rights abuse case there without lying.
Absolutely. There's no question that the Iraqi regime has an appalling human rights record, and that can't be exploited in any other means than to show the truth. But what Amnesty International is concerned, and where the manipulation comes in, is where these human rights records are being used selectively in order to achieve political goals.
Well, who does Amnesty believe is responsible for this revision of the facts?
Well, actually, Amnesty International agrees with many of the findings of the British government. I wouldn't necessarily call it a revision of the facts. I would actually call it incomplete. For example, Amnesty has documented over 170,000 individuals that have disappeared under Iraq's regime over the past two decades. We've also commented on the thousands of unarmed Kurdish civilians killed in the 1988 attacks on Halabja, which we see coming out in the British government's report as well.
Now, since you mentioned that, were they killed by Saddam Hussein or by Iran?
There were different levels of killings on both sides. But the important point to make in this is just where the selectivity comes in. It's being misused at this moment, arguably, to fuel the war machine. And furthermore, we're concerned that it's incomplete. There's no comment about the human rights abuses that have occurred as a result of 12 years of intermittent attacks by U.S. and the United Kingdom, as well as experiencing two wars and long-term sanctions.
So you don't object to the fact, for example, I'm reading here from this report, which is basically, it's titled Saddam Hussein, Crimes and Human Rights Abuses. And one of the quotes is that people are in constant fear of being denounced as opponents of the regime. Is that true or not?
Absolutely.
They are encouraged to report on the activities of family and neighbors. The security services can strike at any time.
Yes, and Amnesty International recently issued an action with result of disappearances, which came as a result of the prisons being opened by Saddam Hussein, which was yet another what we documented as a political move, where, in fact, those individuals were allowed out of prison for a temporary period but have either disappeared or have been re-imprisoned. And basically, it's all because of commenting about the current regime.
Mm. And that occurred, what, just about a month ago?
Yes, it did.
Okay. Arbitrary arrest and killings are commonplace. Between 3 and 4 million Iraqis, about 15% of the population, have fled their homeland rather than live under Saddam Hussein's regime. That's, again, another excerpt from this report. True or not?
Well, again, I haven't gone through and analyzed the report point by point. But one thing I would say is, while it's fair to say that there have been fleeing, and Amnesty continues to document this, we're concerned that the threat of military intervention by both the U.S. and the United Kingdom is actually allowing for another phenomenon, mass refugee displacement, refugee and asylum seekers.
And so Amnesty takes issue with the fact that you feel as though the British government is manipulating the facts here.
In fact, we're concerned more that they aren't including all of the facts. It's important that governments highlight these human rights abuses and take them seriously and take action. But we're concerned, in fact, that it's being used to fuel the war machine, and that, in fact, they're not documenting further abuses, the entire picture, which includes some acts by the governments of the United States and the United Kingdom.
Okay. Any final thoughts on your part, Ariella?
I'd just like to remind both the United States and the United Kingdom that they need to take steps to protect the rights of Iraqi civilians, not to use these human rights selectively, and to respect all the international guidelines accepted by the international community.
Ariella Blatter is Amnesty International's Director of Crisis Preparedness and Response. U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz is in Turkey, pressing Turkish leaders to support an attack on Iraq. The Kurds in Turkey have been at war for over 15 years, and the U.S. and British support for an independent Kurdish state in Iraq further complicates things in the region. Vera Saidapour, founder and director of the Kurdish Library and Museum in Brooklyn, New York, offers a historical perspective.
So when Paul Wolfowitz goes now, he has one aim in mind, and that's to convince the Turks that we can pay them enough money to help their economy, and we can give them enough boost in the EU, so eventually they might get in, although I doubt it. The main thrust of his message is go along with our attack on Iraq. Without attacking Iraq, if the weapons inspections were successful, that would defeat the whole purpose for them, because their aim ultimately is to remake the Middle East.
Well, what is the likelihood that Turkey will decide that they can trust the U.S. and it's in their best interest to actually sign onto this alliance and support the impending war against Iraq, given the fragility of the economy in Turkey right now?
Well, I think that there isn't any doubt that if push came to shove, Turkey would probably go along. The problem is Turkey is riding a very, very a weak horse, because what Turkey's main interest is that if the Iraqi Kurds should get any kind of a situation where they're distanced from Baghdad, that will lead to the same circumstance being demanded by the Kurds in Turkey. The Iraqi Kurds have an agenda. Their agenda is to get as much as they can distance from Baghdad, and also to get as much help as they can and protection from the United States. Turkey wants to get into the EU, and Turkey wants to make sure that the Iraqi Kurds don't get anything that would encourage the Kurds in Turkey to demand more. And then Israel wants to remake the Middle East. The United States wants to remake the Middle East. The reality is this. You have to go back to the first Gulf War, when the Iraqi Kurds were given some kind of an informal assurance that if they went along with Turkey, the world's worst place to be Kurdish, and helped to crush their counterparts, the guerrilla movement in Turkey, which was called the PKK, that they would get a federated Iraq and they would get the north, but they wouldn't get the Kirkuk oil fields. And based on those informal promises, right, then they went along and they did help Turkey. They've helped Turkey the whole time to crush the Kurdish guerrilla movement in Turkey.
And what is the likelihood that the U.S. would actually put them in that position around
this? They will not give them that. They will not give them Kirkuk ever, because Turkey would go to war over that. In other words, Turkey is not going to commit suicide to go along with the United States. They're reaping the consequences of their 1925 decision to outlaw the Kurds. I mean, they were in a ridiculous situation to do such a thing in the first place, because they were fighting a losing battle. I mean, you're not going to deny the existence of not what are now, say, between 12 and 15 million Kurds. In Iraq, there are like 3.5 million Kurds. That's the smallest of the three main groups of Kurds. And the reason the United States has been so interested in Iraqi Kurdistan is because Iraqi Kurdistan is in the strategic center between far larger populations of Kurds. There are about 8 million in Iran. If Turkey sees that the Iraqi Kurds will get some kind of a political distance from Baghdad, then Turkey knows what the next step will be, that the demands of the Kurds in Turkey will be the same. But that's been an obsession with Israel, to break up the Sea of Arabs. And if they could possibly get a federated Iraq with a Kurdish federated north and Kirkuk, they have just recently finished making a deal with Turkey for Kurdish water in Kurdish land, is the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates. That's water in an arid Middle East. And they sure would like to make another deal with Kurds for Kurdish oil from Kirkuk.
So it sounds like a very complicated political mix that U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz has waded into.
Problem is, it's a larger problem than that. In other words, if he has his way, they would absolutely destroy Iraq, take over Iraq, put in a puppet government, which they will do, and then the next step on the road would be Iran and Syria, and to diminish the importance of Saudi Arabia. This is a first step in a long game that's going on, and a game that they have planned out long ago.
Well, how do we know that?
Well, I'll tell you one good indication. About 4 months before September 11th, there was a symposium at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. This was a public symposium, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some major figures from Israel and from the United States, people like Dennis Ross, who was a former U.S. envoy, were there. And they were talking at that time. Now, this is really promoting Israel's interest because it's the major Jewish think tank in the United States. And they were talking about preconditioning the American public to view Iraq as a threat. And Dennis Ross asked some of the participants, how can we best precondition the Americans along these lines so that when we have a plan that we can carry it out? And Senator Sam Brownback answered, Dennis, that's a good idea. All you have to do is put Saddam Hussein on a bumper sticker with a weapon, and the American public will go along. And then Limnor Livnat, who's the Minister of Education in Israel, was asked, what is the most important thing that Israel would like to see in the world? And she said this, we would like to see the U.S. lead the war on terror. And that was 4 months before September 11th, and that's been the entire problem, even with the Kurds, because the Americans don't know that the Iraqi Kurds helped to crush the Kurds in Turkey. They don't know that. And even the situation that has been described, you know, of a connection between al-Qaeda and Iraq in northern Iraq is an issue of territory. And in the wake of September 11th, where every government that had an enemy, everybody that had an enemy, decided to designate them as terrorists, right? You know, the better to cope with them.
Right.
And the Iraqi Kurds, Jalal Talabani, suddenly found terrorists among the Islamist Kurds in northern Iraq on the Iranian border, which is the territory he controls.
Vera Saidapur is also the editor of the journal Kurdish Studies and Kurdish Life. Here in the U.S., the Bush administration's message isn't playing as well in some circles. The city council in Ann Arbor, Michigan, voted 7-1 last night in favor of a resolution against going to war with Iraq. The new resolution presents several reasons for averting war, such as the loss of life on both sides of the conflict, the diversion of local tax money outside the community, and the potential change in national policy toward preemptive strikes in other cases. Ann Arbor joined 21 other cities in taking a position against the war. Diane Wilson is a fourth-generation fisherwoman from a small fishing village in Texas. She's been on a hunger strike for 12 days as part of a group of women calling themselves Code Pink, protesting the Bush administration's plan to go to war in Iraq.
I believe it's a wrong war. It's an unjust war. I believe it has to do with oil and power and saying it has to do about weapons of mass destruction. I just think that's the cover for it.
How was the response of people to you protesting in this fashion, fasting and being in Lafayette Park?
You would be amazed at how many people were supportive and agreed with people that worked within the confines of the administration. We even had some police that said that they didn't want to go to war either. We had a petition that we were getting signatures on. We had quite a few people that just spontaneously started coming down there and helping us pass out flowers that would bring us warm clothes, or if they think we needed warm socks or hot water or anything at all to help the cause. There's a tremendous amount of people that are opposed to the war, and I know all of them kept saying they'd like to see those people that they find on the poll that says they're for war, because they said, we don't know who they are. Well, most of it was against the war.
So it was a very effective way of getting the message across.
Oh, I think it was an extremely effective way, and you know, and we were just barely scratching the surface now.
Diane Wilson was arrested in Lafayette Park on Thanksgiving Eve. She was within three blocks of the White House, violating a restraining order. Wilson and three other women had tried to raise a banner at the gate of the White House, urging Congress to deny the president the resolution authorizing the use of force. In court today, Wilson got a new restraining order that bans her from D.C. for 1 year. Wilson says the punishment is unconstitutional, and she intends to fight it.
I think this is a violation of your civil rights, your First Amendment rights, freedom of expression. This is our Capitol, our Congress. I can't protest before the president. They're effectively blocking my freedom of expression. And after 9/11, they have been stomping on the civil rights of this country. And a form of protest is getting very hard to do, especially if you're in Washington. Like in Lafayette Park, we had police every time we turned around. I know one day I had them there 7 different times.
And what do you think you can do in Texas?
Texas is where George Bush lives. It's where the oil companies reside. And I think there's the fingers of all this war language. And there is anti-war groups in Houston and San Antonio and Dallas. We were doing a march to the bays to throw a wreath into the bay in memory of everybody that has died by violence and terror, not just the people that died in New York, the ones in Afghanistan, the ones in Israel and Palestine. There's avenues in even your smallest community.
What would you do in small communities?
You could start having meetings on it. A lot of times, just getting information out. There's a lot of mothers that have started anti-war groups in their own communities, and they just start their own little protest. You could go to recruiting offices and protest. You could get in front of your post office and hand out flyers. In real small towns, you don't have access to a lot of alternative magazines, so you just read what comes out of very conservative magazines that are pro-war. Just getting information out to people who have been misinformed, because, you know, I don't believe the general population knows all the facts. On Veterans Day, I was here and we was talking to a Vietnam vet, and somehow they were confusing Afghanistan with the towers in New York with Iraq, and then confusing it with the Vietnam War.
So in closing, Diane, what's your message for people in Washington, D.C.?
Never give up on peace, and also join the vigil. It's still in Lafayette Park.
Diane Wilson spoke with Reem Kathuta, Pacifica's Peace Watch correspondent at Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington. Wilson and Code Pink are fasting for peace with a coalition of women's groups, United for Peace, Global Exchange, and Unreasonable Women. The fast is endorsed by the National Organization for Women, Utney Magazine, and others. They are still looking for volunteers to help hold the vigil through International Women's Day on March 8th, and they'll end the vigil with a rally for peace. Peace Watch sent reporter Josh Chaffin to the White House today to see how the vigil is going. It's a cold day in Washington, but that didn't deter a handful of diehard activists from their task, bringing the anti-war message to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
This morning, the Code Pink vigil consisted of a single woman sitting on a homemade quilt sent by a group of kids in Tennessee. Nice quilt. What's your name again?
Autumn Leonard.
What are you doing out here in the cold?
I'm vigiling for the Women's Peace Vigil.
Why would you do that?
Because I think that this administration needs to turn its resources and its efforts from increasing militarism, both at home and abroad, and instead concentrate on things that support and strengthen our communities and our country and our people, like education, like healthcare, like women's and infants and children initiatives, which are the first things that were cut after September 11th. Those sorts of things, I think, are much more important.
But you think sitting out here in the cold is going to help achieve that?
No, but I think sitting out here in the cold and talking to you and sitting out here in the cold and leafleting and sitting out here in the cold and trying to get as many women as possible to sign on this petition and maybe sitting out here in the cold and inviting Laura Bush to come and have tea with me outside, like that might also help do something about it.
You get any interest from the First Lady on that proposal?
I haven't given her the invitation yet, but someday soon.
This woman, she had there was a restraining order on her, and she wasn't allowed to come near Diane Wilson.
Yeah. Her court case is happening right now, actually, at Superior Court.
What do you think about that whole situation?
I think it's a little ridiculous. I mean, I think that if, as Americans who apparently the rest of the world is envious of our freedom and our democracy. We should be able to hang signs wherever we want to hang signs. And that shouldn't mean that we can't come back to this place where it's so important to exercise our right to dissent. You know, Thomas Jefferson said that only true democracy is something that happens through constant revolution. And dissent is, I think, one of the most important ways in which we keep our country free. You know, when only one group gets to say just what they want, no one else, you know, gets to chime in, then we're not living in a democracy, we're living in a dictatorship. And so I think that, you know, ever since September 11th, people haven't been able to come and demonstrate in this park. And I think that's a crime. You know, this is our White House. It's not Bush's White House. This is our White House. This is our country. It's not Bush's country. And if we don't want to go to war, then we shouldn't have to go to war. And if we want to come out here with signs and with banners that say what we think, you know, if we're not harming anyone, she was sitting here peacefully. She had been fasting for 13 days when she got arrested. I mean,
how come you're out here by yourself? There, nobody else, Code Pink chicken out, or
we actually had a lot of people here over Thanksgiving, and I think it's like the first couple days after the Thanksgiving holidays, people have like a lot of stuff they slacked off on or something. I don't know. I think I'm getting that feeling, but there's a lot of stuff coming up this week that's happening. There's the peace pageant.
What's happening on December 10th?
There's a march organized by a group of elders in Bethesda.
Are you getting support from outside of DC?
Yeah, absolutely. September 11th, Families for a Peaceful Tomorrow, the Ground Zero Workers for Peace. We had people here from the Bay Area, of course. We've had people here from Utah. We had people here from Lafayette, Louisiana. You know, people come from all over. You know, that just last night there was a woman from Hungary who came by and wanted a picture in front of our sign.
I'm going to go talk to these people. Who are they?
They're a group of Japanese Buddhists, and they come out here and vigilantly they bang their nonviolence drums and they chant for hours. It's awesome.
Well, my name is Sister Claire Cotta. There's a group of us here, monks and nuns and lay friends. We're fasting for a week and praying this week, December 1st to 7th.
This group of Buddhists out front of the White House is particularly concerned about the issue of depleted uranium. DU missiles are used in heavy tank guns because it's a very dense material that can break through armor. It's also the chief suspect in the illness and birth defects among Gulf War veterans and Iraqi civilians. The U.S. used something like 300 tons of depleted uranium projectiles in the Gulf War under the first President Bush. The Buddhists out front of the White House brought some gruesome pictures of deformed Iraqi kids.
The images are things that we normally would run away from, but we have to look at them.
Can we look at the pictures? Can you talk to me about these?
These particular pictures show, I'm looking right here. There's a four-month-old girl born with an unknown disease. At her birth, her mother just fled because it was so frightening to her. But her care was taken over by people at an orphanage, and she died after 4 months. But
she's pretty horribly disfigured, I guess.
Misfigured, yes. Yeah. Catastrophic levels of unseen cancers in children and birth defects. It shakes you to the core. And you probably know, too, that many of the U.S. Gulf War veterans have had children with also high, high levels of birth defects.
And the theory is that the birth defects have something to do with the depleted uranium weapons that the allies, the U.S. and our allies used in...
Absolutely. Even handling them. You know, you handle this radioactive weapon, and of course they were not instructed in that, and those are the soldiers that the soldiers that had some exposure are the ones that got the children with birth defects and also neurological illnesses themselves.
How's the U.S. government responding to these birth defects?
As far as I know, it's pretty much a cover-up. I've heard recently that there actually are 10,000 U.S. soldiers, Gulf War veterans, who have died since the Gulf War, in overwhelming connection with the depleted uranium. It's really, you know, something out of hell. It really is. So we're just appealing today from the heart, you know, into the conscience of the administration.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.